Our first case this morning is number 17-1817 and 1818, United States v. Barone, United States v. Kelly. Mr. Roth, Mr. Levy, and Mr. Keller.
May it please the Court, Yaakov Roth representing Bridget Kelly. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Sure.
Thank you. Your Honors, I'm not here to convince the Court that the underlying conduct in this case was a model of public service. I'm here to convince the Court that the conduct did not violate the specific federal criminal statutes at issue, which is a very different question. And to be specific, I'm going to be addressing this morning the civil rights and Section 666 counts, and counsel for Mr. Barone is going to continue to address Section 666 and also address the wire fraud counts. And if I could start with the civil rights statutes and convictions, our point is really very simple. The substantive due process right to intrastate travel is relatively uncharted territory, even in general. That's why the prosecutors told the district court they have to cobble together the jury instructions on that count. And the specific conduct here did not violate any clearly established law.
Well, you've got months from 1990, and then you've got two other circuits that essentially say that there is a fundamental right to intra-state travel. Now, you have cases that, when they talk about durational residency requirements, state the other. But the problem that you've got is that you've got a Third Circuit case that says that, and it did a very thorough analysis.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right, Your Honor. And the government's argument does rest mostly on Lutz. But, Your Honor, even assuming that a circuit court decision could suffice to create clearly established law.
What about our own circuit court?
Yes. Assuming that this circuit's law, in the face of a disagreement with other circuit courts, could create clearly established law. And that's an open question. The Supreme Court has said you could have a robust consensus of circuit authority that could suffice. I don't think there's any case that has said when you have a circuit split over the existence of the right that the circuit law alone could create clearly established law. But even let's assume that aside and say Lutz alone could be considered clearly established.
Certainly, in this circuit.
The problem for the government is still that there's a major difference between Lutz and this case, and that is the ordinance in Lutz was a direct legal prohibition on movement, on travel. Government was saying, if you go here, if you travel here, we will punish you. It's a very classic restraint on liberty that implicates the due process clause. But
when this is just the reverse of that, and why doesn't it apply? I mean, that travel was stopped. I mean, thank goodness no one was died as a result of it, but it was on the first day of school, and it was supposedly with the intent to punish the mayor of Fort Lee for not supporting the governor.
Right. But Your Honor, the difference is there was no prohibition. There was no legal restraint on liberty. What there was a practical effect, and allegedly an intended practical effect.
So the legal restraint was the ordinance.
Correct. And the legal restraint in Lutz was the ordinance, and all the other cases really in this area.
So people were put on notice.
That's right. And there were the other cases are similar to Lutz in the sense that there would be, you know, there's an anti-loitering rule. You know, if you're out at this time, we will put you in jail. If you travel here, we will fine you. Those are very traditional, classic constraints on individual freedom from government action.
Does this have to be a clearly established right from the Supreme Court, are you saying, or just within the Third Circuit?
Well, it has to be clearly established, and there's some uncertainty in the law about whether the Third Circuit law can suffice. Given that it's pretty well recognized there's a circuit split on the question, even in general, whether the Constitution protects intrastate travel. But again, even if you were to hold or assume that the Lutz, this circuit's law in Lutz, can suffice to create clearly established law. The facts are still so different from Lutz. And again, Supreme Court has been very clear. The clearly established standard is a demanding standard. I mean, you don't need to have exactly the same facts, but you do need to have something that's sufficiently close.
If somebody had approached you ahead of time and asked you the question, could this possibly violate the right to interstate travel, what would you have said when you looked at the Lutz and the Second Circuit case, the Sixth Circuit case, and others?
Perhaps I would have said there's an argument. I certainly would not have said it's clearly established that the delay, the practical delay from this realignment, can implicate the Constitution in the same way that a direct ordinance prohibiting movement to a particular area would implicate the Constitution. I would have said that's a pretty substantial leap. And maybe the court will agree with it, maybe the court won't, but our point is criminal prosecution is not the right forum for a sort of creative extension of constitutional rights.
So do we rely on the qualified immunity cases and their...
Yes, Your Honor. The qualified immunity case law is the same standard. And, of course, usually in those cases you have the government taking a very hard line on it has to be clearly established, because usually the government is defending its own officials and saying they did not violate clearly established law. But the same principles apply here. And again, we have case after case from the Supreme Court telling the courts of appeals, you have to take this seriously, and if there's a meaningful difference in the factual scenario, in the factual context, you can't say it's clearly established constitutional violation.
So let me ask more of a 10,000 feet question. If you took 242, the Reconstruction Era Civil Rights Statute, out of play here, you still got 666A, and you still got the wire fraud. And
was this the primary reason at trial that these persons were indicted and put on trial?
Was the civil rights count the primary?
Yes.
I don't know what the government, I mean, that's sort of the question for the government, I think, about what the primary reason was. There were three separate theories, and we're going to explain why none of the three theories suffices. I will say the civil rights count did drive the sentencing guideline calculation, so it was an important piece of the puzzle. But I'm happy to move on to the section.
Well, no, I mean, it's an important point that you bring up, that the question is there any Supreme Court law on this? The answer is no.
Right.
And then conceivably some have argued that there is a robust consensus of authority. Maybe. The problem that you have is that in this circuit, in a very long opinion, with a lot of analysis under various provisions of the Constitution, ultimately our court concluded 28 years ago that there is a fundamental right to intra-state travel. And there are cases that say, well, maybe not, because, was it the Carroll case of the Supreme Court, says that we, even assuming for the sake of argument, mm-hmm. that a circuit decision can establish law clearly, it didn't fit in that particular case. Mm-hmm. So you could read into the lines there that by implication, just one circuit doing it doesn't necessarily do it. The trouble is you've got our circuit, the Second Circuit, and the Sixth Circuit, and there's other circuits that supposedly talk the other way, talk about durational residency requirements.
Some do, Your Honor. The D.C. Circuit decision is not about durational residency. I think the Fifth Circuit decision was about durational residency. But again, our primary argument really is not to quibble with Lutz, but to say the context here is very different from Lutz. Lutz was not about traffic. Lutz was about a prohibition on movement.
One could make an argument this whole case was about traffic.
Well, this whole case is about traffic.
That's
right. But my point, that's different from Lutz. Lutz, and again, we're saying, was the violation here? The Supreme Court said the violation from the particular conduct in the case at hand has to have been clearly established. And our central point is you can perhaps draw an analogy between a prohibition, an ordinance that says don't go here, and a governmental action that makes it more difficult to travel there because it increases traffic and therefore makes it take longer. You can argue that analogy. That's the government's argument. But you can't say it's clearly established. It's just a very different set of facts. And, again, given the way the Supreme Court has applied this clearly established test, I don't think one can really fairly say that the violation here of the Constitution was clearly established. I would like to, if I could, move on to the Section 666. I'm going to cut off
questions. That's fine. Go ahead.
I think with respect to Section 666, our basic point can be captured by a set of contrasting hypotheticals. On the one hand, take a mayor who uses city resources to repave the driveway in her private home. Pretty straightforward violation of Section 666. There are actually a lot of cases that involve facts like that. Second scenario, the same mayor uses the same public resources to repave the public streets in the neighborhood in which she lives. I don't think anyone, you could call that an abuse of power. I don't think the government would stand up and tell this court that that violates Section 666, because it's not theft. It may be bad, maybe badly motivated official decision.
It's a misapplication of funds, is it not?
I don't think it is, because
you're saying it's a political decision. It's made every day.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Is there a property interest in the government employee's time, however?
Well, there's an interest in that, but again, the decision here was to take lanes that were allocated to one set of drivers, public drivers, move them to allocate them to another set of public drivers. If that's a legitimate decision on its face, because it's a public use of the lanes, and I think it clearly is, and that's why the government, I think, admits that if the decision had been made based on sort of good faith public policy reasons, that there would be no crime, then, of course, having the people take time to implement it can't sort of change the result there.
So the illegitimate interest that's charged is to punish the mayor of Fort Lee.
Correct. And the government's argument, as I understand it, is this act, this realignment, would have been fine if it had been done in the best interests of the public. It could have been. But here it was not. Here the defendants undertook it for bad reasons, and therefore that's what turns it into a crime. But, Your Honor, if that's the law, if the difference between a lawful use of property and a criminal use of property turns entirely on what's in the decision-maker's head, whether he had a good reason or whether he was truly acting in the best interests of the public, then this statute has absolutely astounding breadth. It's actually would be the honest services doctrine.
Isn't the base for the argument here, from your perspective and that of Mr. Barani as well, that he had the authority to realign the lanes on the George Washington Bridge?
Well, I don't think that's really disputed in the sense that he didn't need anyone's permission. So that is...
Did he really have the authority to do that? To realign the lanes?
Without
going through Foy, and to say that there's a traffic study when there's already a traffic study being done?
So, Your Honor, I think there's two different ways...
What authority did he have on his own?
There's no dispute. I don't think there's any dispute. And this was a question at trial. The government asked Foy, was there any policy that required your approval for this in advance? He said, no, never had such a policy. So I don't think there's any argument he could do this if he had a good reason. The government's argument, as I understand it, is, well, he didn't have a good reason. He didn't have the best interest of the court.
And did the jury make that, in effect, factual decision, determination that he did not have a good reason?
Well, the jury could have. I don't think we actually know whether the jury did. That's an issue with the jury instructions that I'm happy to also address. But let's assume the jury certainly could have made that finding. Our point is that can't be the line that separates lawful from criminal conduct, or else we've turned Section 666 into a all-purpose political ethics code for every state and local official in the country. If a decision is made that is not in the best interests of the public, the federal government can prosecute it. I mean, that is foreclosed and rejected by every canon of construction and every source of authority that has looked at this statute. This court's decision in Chico said specifically, look, you can read the statute very broadly, but we're not going to.
But the statute essentially says if you misapply funds,
yes,
among other things, for an amount greater than $5,000, mm-hmm, for a project that receives federal money,
yes,
you can be held liable criminally.
That's correct. And the question is, what does it mean to misapply? Misapply can be read very broadly to cover any badly motivated decision. That's the government's argument. But the canons of construction tell us that's not how you should interpret this very open-ended term. Principles of federalism, principles...
Wait a minute. What is the argument you're making then, that there was no misapplication?
Oh, there's no misapplication because the lanes and toll booths were put to a public use, not a private use. In other words, all the cases that address misapplication are cases where, for example, you have a public employee come home and run your personal errands, or you use public resources to renovate your house, your private house. Everyone understands that's private, that's not public.
You use public resources here to get even politically.
That was the motivation, Your Honor, but the use of the lanes and the toll booths was for public motorists to cross the bridge, just like it was used every other day during non-rush hour periods. It's very hard to see how using the lanes for the mainline drivers, which is how those lanes were used during non-rush hour periods, both before and after this four-day stretch.
What's the best case that you have in support of your position here?
I would point the court to two cases. This court's decision in Chico, which said we read the statute narrowly to capture the particular evils that Congress was concerned about, not to cover political misconduct more generally that wasn't on Congress's mind, and the Seventh Circuit's decision in the Thompson case, which said, likewise, you could read misapplication very broadly, but if we would read it to cover politically motivated decision-making, that would be preposterous. Those are the two cases most closely on point. I also think the Seventh Circuit's decision in the Genova case, which the government cites, is very helpful because the government uses that case to say, well, political uses of property are not allowed. The facts in Genova were the official sent the public employees on public time to political fundraisers to go door knocking. Well, of course, that doesn't serve any public use. And the court said that violates the statute. Then the court went on to say, of course, if what had happened was that the official had ordered the employees to do speedy pothole repair in politically favored neighborhoods, we wouldn't for a second suppose that that violated the statute. That's basically exactly what we have here. We have politically motivated...
What about the time of the employees? That is, at least one backup toll worker was hired in order to account for the change in the lanes.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the tollkeeper did his job of taking tolls, and they needed the tollkeeper because of the change.
But that person would not have been needed if the change hadn't been made.
No, that's correct. And there's no question the lane, you know, the property was used differently as a result of this decision. I'm not saying that the property wasn't used. I'm saying the property was used for public uses. That tollkeeper wasn't doing Baroni's laundry. The tollkeeper was taking tolls.
But it still rests, I keep coming back to you had to have the authority to do what he did. And I thought that the evidence the government put in is that no one had the authority to alter the traffic patterns in the manner that Baroni did.
Your Honor, what they mean by that, I think, having read the record, is they're pointing to Foy's testimony where he said, well, you have to act in the best interest of the Port Authority. Of course, any agency is going
to
say...
Well, and the Port Authority exists, among other things, to prevent traffic jams and prevent public safety hazards.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
No, take your time.
Getting over a cold.
Been there.
Yeah. I would point the court to pages 1113 to 1115 of the transcript, which is the testimony from Foy about what policies were in place. Where the government says, did you have a policy requiring approval? No. Did you have a policy that would have required some other thing be done? No. And they go through it one by one, and Foy says, no, there was no policy. What he does say is, this was not, I don't think they should have done it. I think, as he said in the email immediately after, this was ill-advised. This was not a good decision. There should have been more communication with Fort Lee. They should have given notice. They should have had more bureaucrats sign off on it in advance. All that is just his opinion after the fact that the decision wasn't made in the best interest of the Port Authority.
One question about traffic studies is that isn't every single traffic study that's ever been done with regard to the George Washington Bridge done by simulation, by computer, not by actually closing a lane or two?
Yeah, Your Honor, there was testimony that the Port Authority does traffic studies by simulation.
So the second in command has to know that, right?
Yeah, but Your Honor, I think the traffic study, respectfully, is a bit of a red herring because our argument is not this was a legitimate traffic study and therefore it wasn't a crime. But they didn't have to be studying traffic. There are 12 lanes.
If you are going to do a traffic study, it's done by computer simulation.
Okay.
What would cause anyone to think, hey, I can just close it down. Besides that, my motivation is to get even with the mayor of Fort Lee. And guess who really suffers? Everybody who's trying to get into Manhattan from Fort Lee.
Your Honor, again, I'm not saying this was a traffic study. The point is there's a certain number of lanes, 12 lanes, that have to be divided between these two entries.
Right.
They always have to be. They had been divided 9 and 3. Baroni made a decision to divide it 11 and 1.
Okay. What about why weren't there significant safety and health standards that had to be looked at? I mean, would your argument be the same if an ambulance could not have arrived in time to save somebody
Right, maybe the government would be making a different argument, some sort of deliberate indifference to safety argument. I don't see how that plays legally into these statutes. And, you know, again, perhaps maybe you can imagine a situation where the Port Authority had a regulation saying before you do any major change, you need to have the public safety officer sign off that it's okay. And had that existed and had Baroni defendants violated that, perhaps we'd be having a different discussion. They don't have any argument like that. Their argument about the wrongfulness of the use of the property turns entirely on the subjective rationale, the political rationale for this allocation of resources. And that, again, that just cannot be what the statute means.
If Mr. Baroni had cleared off all of the lanes coming from Fort Lee and just blocked them, would that be a violation?
Well, I think blocking is different because I think what we had here, I think it's very important, what we had here is reallocation. So they were used by the public at all times. It wasn't like...
Two of the three were blocked for Fort Lee people.
They were right, because they were realigned to the main highway. I think if they had been completely blocked off, we'd have a different case, but all of the lanes at all times were used by the public. It was just a question of which constituency.
If this were going to be done and you were going to go outside a simulation traffic study, wouldn't there be, as in the past, a lot of notice given? By the way, on this day in September, this Monday, everyone is hereby noticed that there are going to be two lanes closed from Fort Lee. Those from Fort Lee need to use other ways to get onto the George Washington Bridge. That wasn't done, was it?
No, it wasn't, and I think the government used that evidence as probative of the motive. In other words, government pointed to that and said, they didn't give notice, that is evidence that they had a bad intent of punishing Fort Lee relative to the other groups. And that's fine. And we're not quibbling with that. Our argument is that motive is not enough to turn an otherwise legitimate allocation of resources among public beneficiaries into a violation of the statute, or else we've completely opened the door to every decision made by every public official, local, state official in the country to federal prosecution on the grounds that they didn't have a good reason, that they had a bad reason or an ulterior motive for what they did. And no case has ever said that, and we have case after case saying we should not be reading these statutes to do that.
May I ask you about the jury instruction?
Please, yes.
I'm interested in what the jury actually heard with respect to the $5,000 limit.
Oh, the $5,000
limit. And also with the mens rea, and also with respect to the fact that the judge instructed the jury that they didn't have to know what the specific property was that was being misapplied?
Okay. Let me take it in two parts because there's two separate instructional issues, I think. The first is the basic instruction on what it means to misapply. Even if the court were to accept the government's theory that it's political motive to hurt Fort Lee can turn the otherwise legitimate use of the lanes into a crime, the jury instructions on that element were far too broad to explain to the jury.
They're the model jury instructions for the Third Circuit, are they not?
They absolutely are, and there's nothing wrong inherently with those instructions. The problem in this case is if you tell the jury you violate the statute if you engage in an unjustifiable or wrongful use of property, in the context of this case, that does not explain to the jury where the line is between the wrongful activity and the crime. And it's we know from the jury's question to the court about whether they have to find political punishment as the motive that they were not sold on that theory. And so as a result of the breadth of the jury instruction and the failure to supplement it with any requirement more specific to this case about what was the wrongful feature that we're asking the jury to find, right? On the government theories, the political motive, or whatever the theory is.
What do you think misapply means?
Well, Your Honor, our position is misapply means to put it to private use.
Put it what?
Put it to a private personal use. That's so what all the cases have involved.
Logically misapply, you're supposed to apply something to X, but you apply it instead to Y. You can add in this case that you apply it to Y and that Y is unjustifiable. Isn't that more simply really what you're arguing?
No, I mean, misapply can be given a very broad understanding.
Well, I'm just saying you and I are just sitting outside here. What does misapply mean? You're supposed to apply federal monies to X, and you instead applied it to something other than X, and it was unjustifiable. And the monies that we're talking about here are for the toll keepers, they're having the necessity to redo the Center and Lemoyne study, and the employees also.
Well, Your Honor, I think misapply is narrower than that. In the context of the statute and in light of the other words with which it appears, I think this Chico and other courts have said it's a type of theft. And all these words are types of theft, and misapply is a type of theft. And specifically, it's about using property that's supposed to be used for the public for a private use.
Again, does a person have to profit by this in some fashion, monetarily or some other fashion?
Well, I think when you're talking about stealing, you're talking about deriving a direct personal private benefit from the property, and that's what all the other cases about misapplication have involved. Again, they're all, you paved your private driveway, you renovated your private house. Again, our point on the jury instructions is if, contrary to our argument, if misapply is broader and it covers any wrongful use in the sense of bad motive, then the jury should have been instructed to find that in order to convict, it had to find that bad motive. And it wasn't. In fact, it was told it didn't have to find the bad motive.
Was any argument ever made to the jury that there was a legitimate reason for realigning the bridge lanes?
I mean, there was argument. Yeah, there was all sorts of argument made about what the reason was.
Other than he believed that there was a traffic study, which doesn't make sense in this context.
I think the
traffic study was being done by somebody else, Center and Lemoyne, and they weren't proposing to close two of the three lanes from Fort Lee.
That's right, Your Honor. I think the fact that the lanes were used for public motorists to cross the bridge is not something that had to be argued to the jury. I mean, that's self-evident to this court, I think, and to anyone. That's why the government doesn't dispute that if there had been a good motive for it, it would have been perfectly legitimate. There's nothing magical about the 9-3 distribution other than the fact that that's what they had been done.
Other than the fact that it's worked.
Well, didn't work.
And when you kind of constrict it by 2/3, it doesn't work. And people are backed up for a long time. EMS facilities couldn't move, for example. School buses couldn't get to schools.
Just Respectfully, there was evidence that it didn't work in the sense that people were cutting through the town to get to the special lanes. But, again, our more significant, our principal argument here is it doesn't matter what was in their heads if there was no criminal act, if there was no diversion of the property to a private use. And there wasn't because they were open at all times to the public.
Well, there was a diversion of the property. You had, I don't think, when I look at pages 45 to 49 of your district court brief, I don't really even be seeing it argued here, that there was like, what, $3,696 for additional tollkeeper money, $4,440 for additional employees, and or for the, I guess, Senator Lemoyne study having to be restarted. And then there was about $5,000 for employees having to do various things than they otherwise would do. That gets you well above $5,000, does it not?
Okay, I'm happy to address the $5,000 as a that's a separate element.
I understand.
A point about all those uses of funds and property is they were used for public use, and that's why they're not a crime. Now, if we want to talk about the $5,000,
what was the public use?
The public use was for drivers to cross into Manhattan. In other words, the lanes were used by the public to drive across the bridge. The only question was, who has access to which lanes? And that's the type of resource allocation decision that governments have to make every day and do make every day and often make based on political considerations. I mean, Your Honor, imagine, for example.
But the motive for realigning that the public use of dollars was what?
The subjective motive for realigning the lanes was the subject of the disputed trial, and the government put in evidence that the purpose was to get back at Fort Lee. We're not disputing that. But imagine, for example, that instead of this realignment, in the wake of the failure to endorse the mayor, someone in the governor's office had said, no more pothole repair in Fort Lee. Send all the pothole repair trucks to the neighboring towns. They're going to get better pothole repair treatment, and Fort Lee will get no pothole repair
treatment. And the worst thing that happens there is one or two motorists have flat tires because of bad potholes. This is way beyond that.
I understand that the consequences are different, but legally, Your Honor, the use of the property in both situations is for a public use, and it's being made for a bad reason. And that's exactly what the Seventh Circuit said cannot be considered a violation of the statute. With respect to $5,000, just because there are a couple questions about that, the evidence was that the additional tollkeeper was about $3,900. $3,000 and some, under $5,000. Senator Lemoyne study,
$4,440.
We think is just completely irrelevant to the question.
They had a restart.
It's no doubt it's a loss that the Port Authority incurred as a consequence of this realignment. It has nothing to do with the value of the property that was allegedly misappropriated. It's a complete happenstance that there happened to be this study going on at the same time. As a result, this unintended, unforeseen, unknown, consequential loss to the Port Authority. That's not what the statute says you're supposed to be measuring with the $5,000.
But are you now disputing this? I mean, it doesn't look like what you did in the district court or here disputes the amounts. I think what you're saying is, for example, some of the monies were considered to be, quote, consequential damages, close quote, that have, I'm not quite sure how that
We're not disputing the amount of the Senator and Lemoyne loss. We're disputing its legal relevance to the statutory calculation. So you've got the $3,600, that's in, putting aside the bona fide compensation exemption that I think is actually applicable here, but let's put that aside for a minute. The $3,600 that's in, you have the Senator and Lemoyne study that, in our view, is legally irrelevant to the question of the value. And then the government says in its brief, there were other employees' time, but they don't point to any evidence other than the sentencing memo in their brief. So I don't know what exactly
was going on. What was given to the jury? What information did the jury have with respect to the dollar amounts?
I know that the tollkeeper information was given to the jury in an exhibit.
Anything else?
They don't point to anything else in their briefs. I don't know if there was anything.
What about the salaries of the employees? Wildstein and Barone?
Your Honor, it's not identified. It's not identified in the government's brief. I don't know if there was something else there, but they certainly don't point to it. They only point to the tollkeeper information. I will say that the bona fide compensation exemption, there's some dispute. It is legitimately, I think, unclear exactly what scope it has, because if you read it too broadly, it sort of swallows everything. If you read it too narrowly, it doesn't do any work. But I do think if it has any application at all, it's got to be in a case like this where these people, the tollkeepers, the engineers, et cetera, are all doing work that they're supposed to be doing that they have no reason to believe is improper or ill-motivated in any way. They would have been paid anyway to do that work.
I thought your argument was in the district court that it wasn't foreseeable, the damages to them, or the additual pay that was due to them.
No, the center in Lemoyne, with respect to center in Lemoyne.
I'm not talking about the employees right now.
No, with respect to the employees, I don't think that was unforeseen. The center in Lemoyne costs were unforeseen, and I think more importantly, just don't represent the value of any of the misapplied property. The employee services was foreseeable insofar as we're talking about the tollkeepers and the engineers and so on. There the question is, was there actually evidence of it, and does the bona fide compensation exemption shield it, because these were people acting in good faith, being paid what they would have been paid otherwise. The only difference is that they were acting on orders that the government says were badly motivated orders. But if this exemption really has any application at all, I think this is...
It's not just a jury issue, the bona fide exemption?
I don't think it's just a jury issue. I mean, you could have factual disputes that would make it a jury issue, but in a case where there's no question and no factual dispute that these tollkeepers were and other staff were just doing their ordinary job,
Is it inconsequential that... the traffic study was just a cover-up to provide an excuse?
I do think it's legally inconsequential to our argument, because our argument is, again, the sort of ruse of the traffic study was the function of that at trial was to prove bad motive. In other words, they would not have done, the reason for this was this bad reason to punish Fort Lee, and we know that because they didn't actually want a traffic study and so on. But for our purposes on appeal, and our legal argument on appeal, we're accepting there was sufficient evidence that the jury could find a bad motive. Our point is that cannot turn this decision into a federal crime, or else you've turned Section 666 into exactly, you've made it the honest services doctrine on steroids. Because any decision that is not taken in the best interests of the public is subject to federal prosecution. And again, from McNally to Skilling to McDonald, the Supreme Court has said that's not happening.
The government's not claiming this is an honest services case.
No, and I think that gets a little bit to the wire fraud counts that my colleague will address. Although I will say their rhetoric in front of the jury was exactly honest services rhetoric, that there was a duty to act in the best interest of the public, and they said that was the core of the case, that they did not act in the best interest of the public. That's exactly the type of language we saw in honest services prosecution that the Supreme Court said that even that statute didn't cover, and now we're getting it under the guise of these other statutes.
But if we decide that the Port Authority was defrauded of property, then the honest services argument really doesn't count.
That's correct, and I'm going to leave that, Your Honor, to my colleague, who will address the wire fraud issues in greater detail.
Did an expert testify before the jury about the $5,000 and how it's figured out?
No. No, Your Honor. There was no expert testimony.
What was it based on? You say it came up in the sentencing memorandum. Was there any evidence before the jury about how you figured $5,000?
Well, the tollkeeper evidence was submitted, so there was a spreadsheet that was created by the Port Authority that showed the names of the tollkeepers and how many hours they had worked and the pay that they had received.
But you're saying they had to work those hours anyway.
Many of them would have, and that didn't reach 5,000. It was under 5,000. And then there was evidence about Center and Lemoyne people came on and said, I worked on Senator Lemoyne, and as a result of the realignment, I had to redo this work. I spent an extra 25 hours and so on. So there's evidence of that. That's not legally relevant. So I don't think any of these pieces gets the government over the $5,000 line.
If that was the case, then why didn't you make a stronger argument on pages 45 to 49 of your district court brief?
Your Honor, honestly, I'm going to have to go back and look at that brief. I know that the issue, sufficiency of the $5,000 issue,
essentially what you tried to
preserved.
Say, fit it in, was the exemption looked to me like 666C with regard to the wages, and that the Senator Lemoyne study was this concept called consequential damages, and therefore it should not fit within 666A.
Yeah, those are both parts of the argument, Your Honor, that the exemption covers some of this, the Senator Lemoyne is irrelevant, and when you add it all up, there's therefore not sufficient evidence. And there hasn't been any waiver argument pressed, as far as I know, about that aspect of the argument.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Your Honor, for your time.
Mr. Levy? You're going to discuss wire fraud, right?
Your Honor, I'm going to discuss wire fraud and also the Section 666 counts. Essentially anything except for the civil rights counts.
For the record, you better state your name. And we'll...
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Michael Levy. I represent Bill Baroni. And as I just said, I'll be addressing the Section 666 counts and the wire fraud counts. And to the extent Your Honor has questions, we can discuss.
Do you wish to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, I wish to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Amber, I think I'd like to go straight to some of the questions that you were asking. It is clear in the light most favorable to the government that Your Honor has identified bad conduct here. And you laid some of that out through your questions and through some of the conversation with co-counsel. And also, it is clear in the light most favorable to the government. This was disputed at trial, but in the light most favorable to the government on appeal, that there were potentially bad effects. I'm not sure it was clear there actually were the types of effects like public safety issues, but there were potentially those effects in the light most favorable to the government. From a moral perspective, I think it would be fair for Your Honors or the jury, and this is largely all they were asked to opine on, to conclude that that was bad, that it was wrongful, that it was unjustifiable. That is not the standard for a federal crime, however. Your Honor asked what was the primary reason why these defendants were put on trial. It was that. There is no previously clearly established constitutional right to travel that this very clearly violated. There was no property crime that the government cared about here. They never even discussed the property in their summation. This was bad conduct in search of a criminal theory for how to prosecute it. And to do that, they came up with a new civil right that's not clearly established. Even respecting the right that's identified in Lutz, it's not this right. A version of 666, an interpretation of it, that would be unprecedented.
If there is a fundamental, if there is, as Lutz said, a fundamental right to travel throughout your neighborhood and, in effect, intrastate, then there were a host of people, myriad of people, that could not travel as they would wish because of the actions of one or two people. Correct?
That's right, Your Honor, but that's different from saying that there is a constitutional right at that level. There's a circuit split over whether, and I don't want to get too deeply into the civil rights, because I'm not as well prepared for that, but there's a circuit split as to whether the right exists at any level. But on a criminal civil rights standard, what we're prosecuting there is a wanton, knowing violation of a clearly established right. when it hasn't been laid out in exactly those terms. The Supreme Court's allowed it if we're talking about selling children into slavery or we're talking about a judge essentially in Illinois raping somebody who appears before him, I mean, things like that. We don't have that here. But moving on to the property crimes, Section 666 and wire fraud, this would also be an unprecedented use of either of those statutes.
Well, I mean, the argument that has been made by Mr. Roth is that bad motive doesn't convert into criminal liability. But the statute specifically says unauthorized, does it not?
It does say unauthorized, and our position is, and I think this was clearly borne out at the trial, that Mr. Baroni was authorized to shift these lanes. Now, why he did it is the government's...
But the testimony that I saw is that no one was authorized technically to do that.
That's the government's essentially circular argument that nobody was authorized to do it for this reason. They said in their opening, that was the big flourish of their opening, is Mr. Baroni had the power to operate the George Washington Bridge. He could have switched this back, was their argument, because he has he was the very top of the food chain, essentially co-equal to Foy, was the testimony.
Well, he never told Foy, never told the public.
True. That adds to the, perhaps, badness of the conduct, but it doesn't do anything to say that it was unauthorized. He had the authority. There really was no contrary evidence at trial at all. We conceded a lot in terms of what the evidence at trial shows in the light most favorable to the government, because we're not trying to quibble over facts where they were legitimately shown, even though it's contrary to what our trial position was. But there was nothing about it.
Then it comes back on 666 to questions that Judge Sirica and I asked. You're arguing he had the authority. The government's arguing that no one had the authority, therefore he didn't have the authority, and the jury made a fact determination that he didn't have the authority. So bad motive really is irrelevant. It really comes down to, did he have the authority, and the jury went the wrong way as far as you're concerned?
We actually have no idea if the jury found that he wasn't unauthorized. The jury instruction on that, and Judge Sirica asked for it, I'm happy to read it. The jury instruction on that was in the disjunctive. So it says misapplication includes the wrongful use of the money or property for an unauthorized purpose. I'm sorry, I'm reading one too high. There we go. To intentionally misapply money or property means to intentionally use money or property of the Port Authority knowing that the use is unauthorized or unjustifiable or wrongful. We don't know whether they found it was unauthorized. Our position is there was no sufficient basis at all for them to conclude that it was unauthorized. It was perfectly obvious from the evidence and from Foy's own testimony.
What would normally be done in order to close two lanes from the Fort Lee side or from the Fort Lee entrances to the bridge? What would normally be done?
If I could quibble for a second with close, shift them. They weren't closed. They were used by other drivers. There was testimony at trial that
wasn't... Well, there were dedicated lanes for Fort Lee people, correct?
They were, because they've been given to Fort Lee 20 years in the past. Essentially, it's the flip side of what happened here. It's a political favor. And the flip side here is you're not in favor anymore.
For a long time, there were three lanes coming from residents of Fort Lee, correct?
Yes.
And most of the rest were up from 95?
And they're coming up the main line from a bunch of different highways.
And so if you were to take the local lanes that had been dedicated for some time and reduce them by two-thirds, what would be the normal way you would go about doing that?
I think the testimony at trial was the normal way would be to give some notice. Right, I think, and that is kind of the nub of the whole thing. The government says that this can't be done at all, that shifting the lanes was illegal because it was done for a political purpose to take something away from Fort Lee to punish Mayor Sokolich politically, that is a personal purpose, by definition, is the government's argument, that political purpose is personal, and therefore you have used the lanes for a personal purpose. Now, what Your Honor is getting at is, on top of that, you kind of didn't do it in the right way. Even if you were going to do it, you should have given some notice. Legally, that other part is not even part of the government's argument. Right? Even the government doesn't contend that that's what makes this a crime. They're saying you can't do it at all, and that's wrong. There just can't be a restriction under 666 that says that a public official can't decide that he's going to reallocate public resources from one group to another group for a political reason, to favor the other group, to punish the group that it's taken away from, and to say that's a personal use, as the government argues.
If two of these lanes that were coming in had great big potholes in them, could Mr. Baroni have them closed off without any problem?
It's an interesting question. I mean, for the same purpose, essentially, as I could fix these potholes, but I'm not going to fix these potholes because it's Fort Lee, and I don't like their mayor, and you know, their mayor is politically out of favor. It's an interesting question. The good news is we're not talking about closing these lanes at all in this case. We're purely talking about
diverting them anyway.
I'm sorry?
They were being diverted.
They were being diverted, and the evidence shows mainline drivers came through faster. Right? I mean, mainline drivers now had 11 lanes as opposed to 9 lanes, and traffic broke faster for them than it did before. As a group, as a society, we could say, it's not a great decision. It didn't do as much for the mainline drivers as it harmed the Fort Lee drivers. This is kind of nasty politics. But we can't, under Section 666, have a rule that allows federal prosecutors to come in and decide that that's a crime. That would literally be unprecedented. The interesting fact of this case is that the defense side is pushing the conservative position that courts have thrown this out. It's only been tried twice. Chico tried something similar to this when a mayor retaliated against two special police officers by firing them because they didn't help out politically. Yeah. And the court said that's not what 666 does.
Yeah,
that's
not the purpose. I'd like you to focus on the wire fraud,
yes,
statute, because to me that's your biggest hurdle of the three claims here. Does the Port Authority have a property interest in an employee's time? And if they do, what's your argument against that? And the Cleveland case seems to me to be not on point. I don't think it's very helpful to you.
Yes, Aaron, I'm not going to touch on Cleveland, although I think it was appropriately raised in co-counsel's brief. I think, again, and this actually feeds nicely into the point I was about to make, that the defense position has cases behind it. This has been done before. The government's position is an unprecedented leap. You can ask them what their case is that says this is okay, and there isn't one. On our side, on the wire fraud, the Supreme Court, through Justice Scalia and then endorsed by the Solicitor General, has said it would be laughable to have a crime in which using government resources for something other than the best interests of the public is wire fraud. They were considering it in the honest services category, and the language they used is precisely what the government used in its summation here. The Supreme Court then said, we're not going to include that in honest services fraud. Notwithstanding that, the government has come up with the approach that, well, every decision that would be an honest services violation inherently carries with it some amount of time to think about it, to decide on it, and to execute on it. And so we, the government, are going to charge that as our money and property. We're going to take the time it took to think about it, and they include that. They include Bill Baroni's time. They include David Wildstein's time. Just thinking about and planning this, this honest services violation that has been rejected in that context, and the time it takes people to go and carry it out, but every decision from McNally to Skilling to, you know, every honest services fraud violation that has ever been brought involves the time that somebody took to think about it and then to tell somebody to go do it. You could always do that. And the reason why, again, our position is backed up by actual case law, is we've cited cases where courts have said, we're not doing that. We get it. It's cute. But as the First Circuit said in Ox, We're not letting in through the back door what the Supreme Court threw out through the front door. And Goodrich from the 11th Circuit is precisely on point for this. If you read Goodrich, that was a case where it was originally charged as an honest services fraud violation that zoning board members had taken bribes to pass out permits. And McNally comes down before trial, which is what makes it an interesting case. So the government, it's not a harmlessness review on appeal. The government switches gears with McNally down. They say, okay, then it's the money and property that you used to hold the board meetings that were all a charade because you'd already been bought off. And the district court, and then affirmed by the 11th Circuit, says that's just honest services again. You can always find that. It's not anything different from that. Yes, maybe the board meeting was a charade, but it was a board meeting.
If Goodrich, you say Goodrich from the First Circuit supports your position on wire fraud?
11th Circuit, right.
11th Circuit.
Yes.
Did you cite it in your brief?
Yes, that's in our reply brief, and we spend a decent amount of time discussing.
But is it in your opening brief?
It's not in our opening brief. It's not in our opening brief. The point is raised in our opening brief that this was a pretextual use of money or property that, to be clear, the government didn't care about at all. This is not the world's largest $10,000 money or property fraud case. This case is about honest services. They used the language of honest services in their summation, and they didn't discuss the property at all. They go through it in about 2 seconds saying, you know, what makes it a crime is there's some stuff that got used. They don't value it, and we can discuss the $5,000, but they never value it in their summation. They don't care about the property at all. They say that the crime here, and we discussed this in our brief, they say the crime here was that these defendants didn't separate politics from their jobs in public service, and they say they violated a responsibility to make every decision in the best interests of the people of New Jersey. And that's honest services fraud. That second part is quoted almost directly from what the Solicitor General disavowed in Weyrock and what Justice Scalia mocked. That's the case they brought. So our position is it is courts routinely find that the government is being pretextual and trying to bring in honest services fraud. We cited 3 examples of it. I think Zauber in this court is another example of a court saying, You're stretching, looking for property, looking for money or property. You found something, but we're not going to count that. This is really an honest services fraud case. Courts routinely find that pretext. There's nothing unusual about a court saying that's pretextual. This is really an honest services fraud case, and it's not a valid honest services fraud case, and you can't bring it.
Your essential argument is that Mr. Brony could not have conspired to obtain or defraud the Port Authority of property he already controlled, right?
That is one of our arguments. So our argument is twofold. First, it's that this is an honest services fraud case, and the property is completely incidental to the decision, to the supposedly dishonest decision. It's not really a money or property
but
case.
Your brief at page 48 acknowledges the government argued that the scheme, the scheme was to obtain money or property, not to deprive the public of an intangible right to honest government, close quote.
They cannot bring facially an honest services fraud case
What I'm saying is on that page of your brief, it appears that you acknowledge that the government made the argument that the scheme was to obtain money or property.
That is their argument. Our point is that's a pretext.
Then the essential argument came down to Brony could not have conspired to obtain or defraud the Port Authority of something he lawfully controlled.
Yes, I think I would say that's an alternative argument in the sense that if we get past this pretext issue I've been discussing and we really are talking about the money or property, we don't think we should get there, but if we do, he didn't deprive the Port Authority of any right to control anyways because logically, and under Zauber, fortunately this court's already found it, he had the right to control. He was the decision maker. Zauber is a case in which the right to control theory was offered by the government also to try to get over the hurdle of the fact that their case really sounded in honest services.
But isn't the hurdle pretty low that he had to exercise his authority in a way that deprived the Port Authority of certain resources, and the resources we've already talked about being the employee wages, the toll keepers, additional tollkeeper monies and the Senator Lemoyne study?
Well, he didn't deprive them of it, first of all. I mean, so on the right to control theory, he already had the right to control, and so he didn't, whatever deceit there was, wasn't to acquire a right to control because he had it. He had the authority to order this. And in terms of the time and the, I mean, essentially all time, it's all employee time. He didn't deprive the Port Authority of it. Those people were off doing Port Authority work. Now, we may disagree with the wisdom of the decision to shift lanes from Fort Lee to mainline drivers as political punishment of Mayor Sokolich. And to be sure, the people of New Jersey disagreed with it. Mr. Browning was promptly fired. Governor Christie's poll ratings and reputation plummeted. The political process handles that, the disagreement over whether this was a good move. But it's not fraud. It's not a deprivation of property for a public official to say either, I'm going to give you something, right? He could have given a fourth lane to Mayor Sokolich. Would have slowed down the mainline drivers a little bit, but he could have done it. He did give, the Port Authority did give $300,000 worth of shuttle buses to Fort Lee. And the evidence at trial was essentially a political effort to try to get an endorsement. That happens all the time, but that's not a crime, and the government didn't say so. Taking back those shuttle buses.
Could you tell me, what is the relationship between Barone and Foy? Foy was obviously not in he was lied to about this, the purpose of this. The traffic study was used as a ruse to get the employees to carry out Barone's directive. So he wasn't in complete control. If he had to develop a scheme in order to get people to agree to it, and then Foy countermanded it.
Well, I would like to point out that he didn't lie to Foy, and the evidence is very clear on that. Even the government in its brief seems to acknowledge that. The conversation with Foy happens after Foy discovers it on the last day, and when he gets called in, he tells the truth. He says this was important to Trenton. That's his explanation. Even the government says he didn't work up some sort of other reason. He essentially acknowledged what it was. So there is no lying to Foy. As for giving in the light most favorable to the government, giving a cover story or a different explanation to the subordinates, that's deceit, but it's not fraud. And courts have been very clear, and particularly the Second Circuit in the cases that we cite, like Regent Supply, that there's a difference between lying and lying to obtain something. He could have just said, do this. The lying, perhaps, made it go over easier. Blagojevich in the Seventh Circuit says you really can never expect a politician to say, I am doing this for a political reason. The same could be true of the buses, the $300,000 worth of buses for Fort Lee. If the person writing the check said, is this really the highest and best use of $300,000? And Mr. Browning had said, yes it is. That's deceit. It's not fraud. He has the authority to do it, and as Blagojevich points out, there's never going to be, and there is not in federal criminal law, a requirement that public officials make clear their political motives when they transfer property from one set of constituents to another. So on the issue of deceit to the subordinates, it's just not fraud. It didn't deprive the Port Authority of anything because Mr. Browning already had the right to control. It could be a different case had he deceived Foy, but he did not. When asked by Foy, he gave the legitimate reason that it was important to Trenton, that it was political, and Foy shut it down. And then, the normal, ordinary political process that one would want took hold, and everybody was fired. And that is where it is. It's the federal government.
If he had told the truth to the subordinates, they would have told Foy, would they not?
They might have, they might not have, but it doesn't change Mr. Barone's authority. It doesn't become a fraud at that point just because he's trying to exercise his authority that he has in a way that his subordinates might not like. I mean, again, if that is the rule, it makes politics unworkable because it means that in every instance, a public official who has the authority to allocate resources, to fund something, to site a military base somewhere, to site a prison somewhere, to distribute any number of things, has to tell everybody below him the honest reason, because if he did not, because by not telling them, he's depriving them of the opportunity to tell somebody above. That can't be the way federal criminal law makes politics work. Again, this is conduct that appropriately anybody in the light most favorable to the government might find disturbing, but not conduct that is criminal. And all the jury was asked was whether it was wrongful, which allowed them to render a moral judgment. If I could take just a moment on the issue of the $5,000, because our position is slightly different from our co-defendants. The $5,000, from our view, is an instructional error. We are not, we join in their argument on sufficiency of the evidence, but our point is the Center and Lemoyne study, which was specifically called out to the jury by name, you may consider the Center and Lemoyne study as the value of whatever was taken, even though it's downstream consequential damages. We objected to that. It was error. And when you weed that out, that was one of two numbers that was ever actually presented to the jury. All that was presented to the jury was, here's the value of the toll keepers, and it comes in under $5,000. Here's the value of Center and Lemoyne, and it was, I think, over
$4,440.
And when you add those together, you are over $5,000. Now, you take away Center and Lemoyne because it was wrong, it shouldn't have been included, and you are left with a number that is below $5,000, and then also these numbers that the government comes up with in sentencing without ever citing any evidence. And I don't know. Nobody knows what the jury would have done with those numbers. There are good answers to why those numbers, wherever they come from, and it's still not clear.
Were both of those numbers actually given to the jury? Were they both in evidence?
The Center and Lemoyne number and the toll keepers, those were the two numbers where a number was given, where there was a chart and here are the hours. So those were the two. Now, for the Port Authority employees like Baroni, Wildstein, and some others, there were sort of vague references to how much time they spent on it. Nobody knows what those people made per hour.
They were salaried employees. They were salaried employees.
I don't know, to be honest. That's the problem. I don't know if they were annual or if they were salaried. The government may have dumped in a bunch of documents in the last minute of its case, and it may be buried in there somewhere. I don't know if the jury ever saw those. I don't know if the jury, it was never discussed with them. It was never added up.
Okay.
And the government in a harmlessness situation, remember, that's where we are if the court agrees that Senator Lemoyne shouldn't count, in a harmlessness situation where they have to argue that the jury absolutely would have found this anyways, has not even told us where their numbers come from in terms of evidence. I'm happy to address the jury instruction point if your honors have any questions, but otherwise I see I'm fairly far over my time.
No problem. We'll get you back on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We haven't followed the club yet.
May it please the court, I'm Bruce Keller, I represent the United States. I wasn't going to start this way, but a lot of attention has been paid to the $5,000, so let me get that out of the way, because it was actually resolved principally on the first day of trial through stipulations, and it was on the last day of trial during the summation at pages 5295 to 96 of the joint appendix that the government reminded the jury how the money in controversy was established. And it was established, putting aside Center and Lemoyne, I'll get to that in a second, in the following way. First, there was Government Exhibit 8000, which were the stipulations that the parties had agreed to. And among the stipulations the parties had agreed to were payroll records from the Port Authority. And the payroll records were for the toll takers and for the Port Authority employees who were put into the service of this fraud. And that is absolutely clear that it was the $3,600 in plus in toll taker overtime. That's at page JA1686-87. And it is also in the testimony.
Was it just $3,600? I thought it was $3,696.
It's a little higher plus. I was just rounding off, Your Honor, because even if you round off and even if you exclude Center and Lemoyne, you're over the $5,000. I just want to get through this relatively quickly because there shouldn't be any dispute about it. The testimony then of witnesses Amy Wang, Victor Chung, Umang Patel, and David Wildstein then said how many hours each worked on the fraudulent traffic study. And that's at pages JA2819-23, 2840-41, 2859-63. And David Wildstein said how many hours he spent in service of the fraud and also how many hours Mr. Baroni did. And the government used the low end of the estimated ranges of all of this testimony. Wildstein's at 1951 of the record. So through a combination of the stipulations, Government Exhibit 8000, the payroll records, which are Government Exhibits 1148-74, and the testimony that I just gave you from these witnesses, we arrived at an hourly rate. Toll takers was a solid number. The other one had to be calculated on a pro rata basis. So we arrived at an hourly rate. Why? Because as we know, the way that you measure the money in controversy for purposes of 666 is fair market value. And I think it's the height of irony that big firm lawyers would quibble that hourly rates do not represent fair market value. They clearly do. So it's not an issue that you need to tarry long on. It's all in the record. It was resolved principally through the stipulations on the very first day of trial. And so now I'd like to start by clarifying the following.
Did you ever argue to the jury that the Center and Lemoyne study was a way to assess the value here?
Yes, that was the point of putting that evidence in. And with respect to Center and Lemoyne.
And the jury was charged on that.
The jury was charged generally on how fair market value is the way that you assess whether the $5,000 threshold has been satisfied for purposes of 666. And it was charged at fair market value, and you know what the evidence is. So that the math was laid out in summation by the government. And again, that's it. 5295-96.
Was the government relying upon this cost of the study?
It was included as well, but when you include that, you get to $14,000, almost $15,000. My point is that even without it, you're above the $5,000 threshold, nearly double, because you're up around $9,000. If you want to take a hard look at Center and Lemoyne, I encourage you to do so, because frankly, we all know that the definition of fair market value is willing seller and willing buyer. And we use the example in our brief, hypothetical, but there's been a lot of them. Hypothetically, the Port Authority decides to rent out access to the George Washington Bridge to a movie production company. How would you price what that is? You'd price all of the costs embedded in using what would be normally the bridge to cross the Hudson for a movie set. And Center and Lemoyne is fairly included just on a fair market value analysis, which is the only analysis, and there are many ways to calculate fair market value, but there's no reason why this isn't one of them. So the main event in my mind is how can I help you best advance the analysis and the issues in this case, and I think that I have to start by being very clear on the case that we really brought, which focused on the lie that matters. It was spelled out in the indictment. That's page 120 of the Joint Appendix. It was proven at trial as the lie that was necessary to obtain the Port Authority resources, the control of the toll booths and the lanes, and the employee services. And the jury was specifically instructed that they had to conclude, in order to convict, that this lie, this falsehood, this fiction, was material and that the defendants knew it was a fraud in order to convict. And that is in the wire fraud and the good faith instructions, which, of course, are in the record. And it was so important, actually. This is really... Your Honor.
With regard to the wire fraud statute, you have to obtain property.
Yes.
And they focused on two words, obtain and property. But let's do the first. How did they obtain property under the waterfront statute?
So they obtained property in the form of the employees' services that we just discussed. They clearly were diverted from their normal operations to service of the fraud. I don't think there's really any case that suggests employee time, if obtained by fraud and used for an unauthorized purpose, doesn't qualify as property. In fact, wire fraud is one way to get to the fraud. 666 is another way to get to the fraud. There's an exception in 666. Your Honor identified it earlier, 666C. It carves out bona fide employee services. It tells you that if employee services are pressed into service for something that's not bona fide, and I'm going to explain in a second why this can't be bona fide, it obviously counts for purposes of fraud prong of 666, and it counts under the same logic for purposes of the wire fraud. But the point that I think is most important is that the fraud cuts across all three statutes of conviction and was absolutely essential to the conviction because the jury was told in no uncertain terms it could not convict unless they found the traffic study was a fraud, that means it was illegitimate and unauthorized, and that the defendants knew it was a fraud. Now, the defense opened on this theme below. At pages 702, 726, and 729, they used the good faith instruction, which they're not, the concept of good faith at the opening, not always entitled to good faith instruction when you have a specific intent statute like the three here, but they got it. And they knew they got it, and so they used it. In fact, defense counsel below, at page 4620 of the record, said to the district court that this was the whole case. Good faith. Do I believe the traffic study is legitimate, or am I just pretending, because it's really a fraud, to get these employee services and control of the Port Authority resources in the form of the toll booths? Which one is true?
Who came up with the idea that there was to be, the rationale was to be that there was a traffic study taking place?
Was that Wildstein? That was Mr. Wildstein, Steve, and the lie he told is spelled out in detail in the record. We want a study, he told his Port Authority colleagues. We want to study what traffic looks like if, down the road, we decide to reduce the lanes on a permanent basis. And Mr. Wildstein told the jury that was never the truth. He told them at page, and this is key, 1621 of the record, there was never any Port Authority reason to use the Port Authority resources that way. We know it was a lie because no one ever looked at the results of the traffic study. All the people employed, and this goes to whether they were, in fact, bona fide employees doing bona fide work, all testified down the line, no one ever cared to check on what the results of the traffic study was. And Wildstein went further. He basically admitted that the traffic study was an elaborate fraud. It was a paper trail. His words, a cover story to hide the true purpose for reducing the lanes. And part of the paper trail is right there in the supplemental appendix that we provide at the court. Pages 41 to 49 shows the diagrams of how reducing from 3 to 2 to 1 would back traffic up into Fort Lee. So it was an absolute fraud used to obtain property of the Port Authority.
Well, now, the defendants here suggest that this is done all the time in governmental circles, that a mayor will say, I'm going to pave Second Street because it's in disrepair, when he's really trying to get back at his opponent from the last election, or somebody, some neighborhood that doesn't vote for him, instead of putting it on Fifth Street, he's paving First Street. Is that the same thing we're talking about here?
It's not the same thing, and I think the reason it's not the same thing is that each one of their hypotheticals is missing something very important. In all the hypotheticals in their briefs, in all the hypotheticals that were discussed earlier this morning, they are missing the elements of the statutes of conviction. In the hypos that we've gone through today and in their briefs, there's no fraud. There's no affirmative misrepresentation. There may well be bad motives, but that is not an element of any of the statutes of conviction.
So frauds to the public. The mayor says, I'm going to pave First Street. It's in disrepair. He's ready. It's not in disrepair. Fifth Street's in worse repair, but he's not going to pay Fifth Street.
That also exposes one of the flaws in the hypotheticals. In that situation, we have an official with obviously unfettered authority in the sense that an affirmative misrepresentation is not necessary to get the paving done. That is the use of paving resources to pave roads, and that is very different from this case. So the problem with each of these hypos, and actually it's a bigger problem, because they posit an affirmance in this case as setting the law down on a slippery slope, but they use hypotheticals to illustrate the slippery slope that don't involve the facts of this case. There's no affirmative fraud. There's an official with absolute authority to get the work done without having to lie to colleagues. The evidence here is to the contrary. Their hypos are not crimes. The government does not believe that any of the hypos that they have trotted out are crimes. But more importantly, it's not this case. What is this case? This case was summed up by the vice chairman of the Port Authority, Mr. Reckler. He was a defense witness. He said that Mr. Barone was engaged in unauthorized, his word, unauthorized conduct. He said it on direct, and he said it on cross. And Executive Director Foy, to whom Barone reports, at least on paper, that much was established. Mr. Foy said Barone's conduct was an aberration. Page 1152 of the record. And it's not a shock that this testimony came out at trial, because if it was a legitimate traffic study, we've gone through some of the evidence showing that it wasn't, why the lies? Why the cover-up? Where is that in any of the hypotheticals that you've heard today or seen in their briefs? It's not there. This is no slippery slope. Their hypos simply don't meet the challenge of dealing with the evidence that was put to the jury and the instructions that were put to the jury. So let me swing back to that for a second.
What's your best precedent to show these are violations of the wire fraud in 666?
So I think that
must be a real good case on it.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I cut you off.
There must be a good case on it.
Well,
or you wouldn't be here.
Yes. I think that our best case on wire fraud is one that I like a lot. That would be the Ferriero case, because in Ferriero, the county party chairman did not disclose his illicit motive to the towns that he was dealing with. That's not why he was convicted the second time around, because that was not an honest services fraud case, notwithstanding the failure to disclose. Instead, he was convicted, that conviction was affirmed, as a result of an affirmative misrepresentation that I have no interest in these organizations, in these companies. You can hire them. That was an outright affirmative lie, and Ferriero stands for the proposition that an affirmative lie is at the core of wire fraud. It's not a novel proposition. And indeed, you heard the defense counsel say that some of their best cases were Goodrich and Chico and Zauber. I agree those cases will help you get to the right result in this case. I agree because in Zauber it was absolutely clear, and I also agree with their characterization that these are cases in which the government, after McNally, had to retrofit honest services cases that were conceived as honest services cases, that were charged as honest services cases, that were tried as honest services cases, that are retrofit those cases into a property fraud case, and they couldn't do it. And they couldn't do it because, unlike this case, it wasn't charged that way, wasn't tried that way, and the jury wasn't instructed that way. And so that's why in Zauber, this court said that was a vain effort to retrofit Zauber into a property fraud case. Same thing in Goodrich. In Goodrich, it is the case that the 11th Circuit said bona fide zoning decisions is not a property right. Not a novel proposition there either. Cleveland, basically, the Supreme Court's Cleveland case stands for that proposition as well. That's not property. That's honest services. So it didn't work in Goodrich either. But that doesn't help you decide this case, because there clearly was property and there clearly was an affirmative fraud. And SECO was actually helpful to the government. When was SECO decided? It was decided before the trilogy of Supreme Court cases in Salinas, in Sabri, in Fisher, in which the Supreme Court said, we know what you're thinking, courts of appeal, but these are really expansive statutes, and you should apply them as written. Now, in SECO, that was before the trio of cases, the question was, is this bribery in order where we give you a job? It's the sort of the carrot approach. Or is it retaliation, the stick approach? Because if it's retaliation, it doesn't fit within the bribery prong of 666, which, by the way, is 666A1B, not involved in this case at all. It was a question of on which side of the bribery line are these jobs that we're handing out or taking away fall. Ultimately, in SECO 2, this court said it's really retaliation, so it's not covered. But what's most important about SECO 2 is that it characterizes SECO 1 as being turning solely on the fact, or principally on the fact, I should say, that there's another statute, 18 U.S.C. 601, that covers the exact same thing. And so, because we don't really believe this 666 is so broad, and we're not going to read it to overlap with 601 absent clearer instruction from Congress that the overlap was intended. Doesn't involve this case at all. We're dealing with the fraud prong of 666, the misapplication prong of 666, and the conversion prong of 666.
Before we leave that and then deal with the fundamental constitutional right issue, question is, you mentioned the Senator Lemoyne study, and you said there was something put, was it put before the jury? I just want to clarify that. Or was it done at sentencing?
No. Everything was put before the jury.
And where in the record is it the Senator Lemoyne study was?
Your Honor, I don't have that. I'll certainly send it to you. But there was detailed evidence from the people who were involved in the Senator and Lemoyne study as to how much time was involved. And what the contract
they came up with a precise number, the 4440.
There was a precise number. It was in the record.
But I'm just trying to find out when was it put in. Where was it put in?
I have to get back to you on that site, Your Honor. I apologize for not having that one at the ready.
All right.
And the reason I don't have it at the ready is because you could exclude it, and you still cross the $5,000 threshold.
Tell me again who were the toll workers whose compensation was necessary, or a necessary part of this deceitful act, and the amounts.
So the amounts were $3,600 plus
and
for overtime.
For
a toll taker.
How many toll takers?
I'm not exactly sure how many, more than one, because they were reporting during the four mornings when the lanes were reduced to one. You had one toll taker in the remaining local access lane, and that toll taker was working away in the service of the fraud, but working away, and would need a bathroom break. And in order to make sure that the toll was not shut down completely, but could continue to be used,
needed a backup.
They had to have a backup,
right,
so they could take their bathroom break. It is for that purpose that the overtime was required. And in fact, the record shows that Baroni and Kelly were amused by that.
But if all 12 lanes were still in use on September 9 when this started, why would there be needed overtime for toll keepers? In other words, they're still in use whether you use three lanes for a Fort Lee entrance or only one lane for a Fort Lee entrance.
There was always one lane for Fort Lee.
Correct, but you went from 9 to 11, so you have never were there, you can't do more than 12. None of the 12 were taken out of play for motorists. They were just taken out of play for certain motorists. So how do you say that toll keepers would have overtime as a result of this when all 12 lanes are in use at all times?
Because the testimony on that was, in order to spell the worker in the one remaining lane, they had to have somebody come fill in for that person completely regardless of the other 11 lanes. In other words, they didn't want to shut that lane down completely. That would have brought such attention to this, the fraud would have been exposed probably much more quickly. And here's the significance of that one remaining lane, Your Honor.
So the person that is in the one toll lane for Fort Lee residents would get a break, but
and be spelled by somebody who came in when they weren't supposed to work.
But if it was three lanes, those persons would still get breaks, would they not? I'm just trying to figure out, if you've got 12 in play, and 12 are always in play.
I think that, well, you know what, Your Honor? I'm not sure how much the record goes down on this, but I do know it shows this much. Ordinarily, there were three lanes. They were taken away from the Fort Lee local access, and so you had only one toll taker then, and I think this is the key. It was a combined easy pass cash lane. So you had to have somebody there who could take the money. And you had, as a result of that, and they knew this, when you combine easy pass and cash, you're absolutely guaranteeing huge backups, right? Anybody who's been stuck with an easy pass transponder in a cash lane knows that. The other lanes, pressed into service two or more for the main line, were a combination of easy pass only or cash only. And it may well have been, and now I don't know how much the record shows on this, that the other lanes were also easy pass lanes and no toll takers necessary. What the record does show is that with respect to the combined easy pass toll cash, you had to spell that worker, and the way that it was spelled was through people who otherwise were not on duty that day because there was no one else to staff them. That's
so the 3,600. The 3,600 figure only relates to the backup.
Only relates to overtime for the people who spelled the toll worker on that one lane.
More than one backup?
It was not always the same person. That's what the payroll records show. The stipulations I referred to earlier.
So, what of those of the normal three lanes? How many were easy pass that you would have for Fort Lee residents? We don't. I mean, that's not in the record.
I don't know that that's in the record, but it was a combination. I do know this: the allocation was pure easy pass or cash. I would be speculating, because I don't know what the record shows in terms of whether it was...
Because if two of the three were easy pass and only one was for pay, needing a toll keeper, then there wouldn't be any need for overtime because that one toll keeper would be given breaks before and after the same.
Well, I think more important than the lane allocation, Your Honor, I don't mean to minimize the inquiry, is that Baroni and Kelly were specifically told by Wildstein that you had to have these people there for overtime, and you couldn't do it any other way. So going in, they knew this money was going to be wasted.
So did they? You're saying there was evidence ahead of September 9 that there had to be brought in additional toll keepers other than those normally assigned for that particular day?
Yes.
And where is that in the record?
Your Honor, I know that we cited it in our brief. I have it somewhere in my notes. I know I can give it to you before I leave, but I don't have it at the ready this second.
Okay.
But it is absolutely clear that in the record there is evidence. In fact, it's not only testimony. There's an email in which Wildstein is advised, you have to have overtime. He says, got it. We know we will have. I'm authorizing the overtime. And he reported it to both Baroni and Kelly. So right. They knew going in.
If you would supplement the record, let's turn now to the 242 issue, the deprivation of a civil right.
So I think the most important thing to start with there, Your Honor, is that there's no circuit split. I think the difference between us turns on how you define circuit split. There is no case that says Lutz is wrong. And Mr. Baroni's brief at page 53 absolutely mistakes Hutchins when it says Hutchins stands for the proposition, and Hutchins is a D.C. Circuit case, criticizes Lutz. It does not. Indeed, a D.C. case, which is one of the ones that assumes a right of interstate travel might be implicated, says if there is a sufficiently draconian restriction, that would implicate or could implicate the right depending on other facts. There's no criticism of Lutz. More importantly even than that is that when Hutchins seems to suggest that other courts have split on this issue, one of the cases on which it relies is the Sixth Circuit case, which was overturned, superseded by Johnson against Cincinnati, a subsequent case to Hutchins, which clearly endorses the Lutz analysis. I think that much has been made of the split, when in fact what you have are courts talking about different issues.
You still have the Wright case, do you not, from the Fifth Circuit?
Yes, and Wright is one of those right-to-commute cases, and I think that's where the difference lies. I think, you know, in their briefs they have said quite a bit, we need to define the right with a sufficient degree of particularity. We don't disagree with that, because it helps the analysis as to whether or not a reasonable official would understand that what they're doing is violating the right. So be specific about the right, because that's how we decide whether somebody's reasonably could understand it's being violated.
And so you're saying that an official in Texas in the Fifth Circuit wouldn't be violating anybody's civil rights by the same conduct?
I'm saying that in the context of right, a right to compute context, or a residency requirement context, no court, those cases are quite different from the case we have here. You heard earlier Mr. Roth suggest that this is so different from any other case, including Lutz, that nobody could reasonably understand that gridlocking a town for four mornings in a row would violate any rights. I don't think that's fair characterization. This is an easier case. In all of the residency
laws... Well, in Lutz you had an ordinance that prescribed certain kinds of conduct, and here you don't have that.
That's not exactly why I was about to say this is an easier case. In Lutz and in all of these other right to interstate travel cases, at least you have official, legitimate governmental action. You have the opposite of that here. It goes to the knowledge of the defendants as to whether they were a clearly established right was being violated, but it also goes to the multi-step analysis you have to go through to determine whether the right has been violated. Because first you need a restriction, and there is nothing in the law that says it has to be an ordinance. You need a restriction. And then you have to measure the restriction against the legitimate governmental action involving restricting the right. And then you have to measure, as the third step, well, how does that match up against the standard of review, whether it's strict scrutiny, intermediate scrutiny, or rational basis? The middle step in this case is entirely missing, and that goes to why I said at the outset, the fraud is all. You do not have legitimate governmental action in this case. That's what makes this case stronger than Lutz, because it really makes it very much like what happened in Lanier. In 241, 242 cases, you need an official acting under color of right, some type of official action. That's what you have here, but there never was really an official action. It was all a fraud. It was Judge Lanier molesting women in his chambers. That was an official action. He used his power as a judge to accomplish that, but nobody would argue that's official action. And when it got up to the Supreme Court...
Everyone can agree that what Lanier did was wrong, criminally, morally, any way you look at it. Here, the question is there a clearly established constitutional right of intrastate transport?
So, correct. You have the second, third, and sixth cases saying there is. When the right at issue is a point A to point B, can I get from point A to point B?
You've got the fifth saying there isn't, the fourth, albeit under privileges and immunities, saying there isn't, some criticism of Judge Silberman in Hutchins, and you've got the Supreme Court saying that it's got to be clearly established, and so, it isn't clearly established if there is a circuit split.
I agree with all of that. So I come back to the point, is there really a circuit split? Nobody has said Lutz is wrong. Nobody, no circuit involving a point A to point B case has said Lutz is wrong or otherwise said there is no right to get from point A to point B. And ultimately, let's go through the analysis in Lutz. As Your Honor indicated earlier, it's extremely thorough, it's extremely cautious, and it's very conservative. Because in that opinion, Judge Becker made sure...
Until the end. We're going to take general principles from PACO and ordered liberty, etc., and we're going to say, because we have to rule, that there is a right constitutional right to travel freely within your neighborhood?
Well, but just in this case.
Just in this case.
And yes, but it wasn't made up out of whole cloth. There is a lot of language.
There was a lot of cloth in that case.
Your Honor, you can say that, I cannot.
God bless Chief Judge Brecker.
It's a very conservative analysis. It uses the narrowest conception of what substantive due process is all about because the court, as Judge Brecker candidly acknowledged, was being forced to rule on something, and he wanted to make sure that that ruling, and the panel agreed with him, the rest of his colleagues, was well-grounded and didn't go any further than necessary. I submit to you this case does not involve an extension of Lutz. It's actually more narrow because of the missing component, at least in Lutz. I think it's a strength to us here that there is no ordinance involved because there's nothing even approximating legitimate governmental action. Again, that was put to the jury. The question of whether or not there was fraud here, and I think in this case, just so I don't forget the point, 666, fraud prong clearly satisfied, and in this particular situation, not so much difference between fraud and conversion and misapplication.
Let me ask two questions going back to 242. Was there any consideration given to taking the easier path that this was, the fundamental right was a right to interstate travel?
Your Honor, that is a great question, and the answer is consideration was given, and the answer is that was not brought because, again, the government went by the elements and the facts that discovered as a result of the investigation, and those facts show that the plan, the fraudulent scheme from the outset, was to gridlock Fort Lee. There is no doubt in our mind that people trying to get across the George Washington Bridge were also affected, and you could claim that they too had their rights violated, and that was a right of interstate travel, because obviously you can't do a U-turn on the bridge, you got to go. But the evidence is that the plan was to gridlock Fort Lee. People south of Fort Lee couldn't get through it. People in the middle of Fort Lee were stuck for hours. We've been accused of being breathless on this, but there's no controversy here. Kids were stuck on buses. EMS workers had to abandon their ambulances. This was an extraordinary gridlock, not seen since the Twin Towers came down on 9/11, and you had to shut the George Washington Bridge. Everybody was affected in the immediate area, or thousands of people were, and some probably were trying to get across the bridge. But the scheme, the fraudulent scheme, was proven in abundant evidence that it was to gridlock the town, people trying to get from point A to point B, not necessarily across the George Washington Bridge. So the answer is, we thought about it. We brought the case we knew we could prove because the defendant's own emails, time for traffic problems, in Fort Lee, said just that. It didn't say, let's cause traffic problems for people trying to get to New York over the George Washington Bridge. It's an example of making sure that the facts and the elements were checked off one by one, and when we brought this case, we could make it stick. That is the reason.
One final question before you sit down. Factual question. When this first happened on September 9, there was a lot of publicity about the backlog of traffic coming from Fort Lee onto the George Washington Bridge, was there not?
There was publicity, yes.
And second day was even more publicity, was there not?
The record does not show us how much each day and whether it was incremental, but I don't think anyone could legitimately dispute that there was publicity. I don't think the record shows us just how much, but we're not going to deny the obvious.
All of this invites the dumb question, why did Foy wait till the fourth day to weigh in?
So Foy's testimony on this is he did not know sooner. He doesn't explain, and there is nothing brought out of cross-examination in any detail as to why he didn't know sooner. What we do know is this. When he did find out about it, he acted immediately to countermand the lane reductions. And we also know, I heard earlier that Mr. Maroney told the truth to Mr. Foy. I don't think that helps him very much. When he said it was ordered by Trenton, he couldn't get it reinstated. Even when chairman of the PA, David Sampson, tried to intervene to get him reinstated. If anything, that single piece of evidence shows you just how unauthorized and aberrational, in Foy's words, this was. It was, and you asked the question earlier, how long had the lanes been in place? The answer is decades. And the breach of protocol that was referred to by Vice Chairman Reckler, their own witness, absolutely clear. Before I sit down, I know I'm way over, and I...
Everybody's way over. We haven't stopped anyone yet.
I appreciate that very much, Your Honor. I want to make one last point on misapplication, because you could just affirm on the fraud grounds alone. You have it in wire fraud, and you have the fraud prong of 666. But misapplication has a core meaning, and that core meaning comes from 18 U.S.C. 656, and that's a banking statute where the same term, misapplication, is used. And this court in the United States against Metzinger back in 1951 recognized the core meaning of misapplication. It's the use of someone else's property, not for their benefit. And that there, this court was quoting the Supreme Court in its prior interpretations of 656. That is exactly this case. And the reason this case is at the core of misapplication is that's the definition that's derived from 656. And what's clear about this is Judge Sand's treatise, the model instructions in this circuit and the Eighth Circuit, and the instructions for 666 adopted in the Sixth Circuit, all make clear Judge Sand is, that's where you go. And Judge Sand says, look, it's the lineage is the banking statute. The core of misapplication is exactly as defined by this court in Metzinger. But what we have in addition to in the normal six or in some 6-6 cases, you can go beyond the core. Because even when the property is used without permission by somebody else who's not authorized, and it does benefit the owner, that's not a defense. That's why the standard instruction in this jurisdiction and the 8th and the 6th say benefit to the owner is not a defense, because that takes you into the purpose for 666, which is what? To protect the integrity of the organizations that are receiving federal grant money. And Congress has made a decision that if you're going to receive federal grant money, you should use it for the purposes for which it was given. Now, this is not that case. This is not an improper use of grant money case per se. But in the cases where that was the issue, it doesn't matter if you buy computers for the police force when the grant money was for educational training. That's why the normal 666 misapplication concept is even broader than this case. We are at the core of misapplication. And the reason I want to
I think the jury instruction was that it had to be back to my question to the other side. Misapplication is thought colloquially, you're supposed to give the money to X, but instead of applying it to X, you instead apply it to Y unjustifiably. And sure. So what you're saying is unjustifiable Y can still be a legitimate lawful function. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that, this is at 5109 of the record, the standard instruction in this circuit says that to intentionally misapply money or property means to intentionally misapply money or property of the court authority. Very specific. Criticism from the other side, not sufficiently tailored, not so. Of the court authority, knowing that the use is unauthorized or unjustifiable or wrongful. What fills the content of unauthorized, unjustifiable, or wrongful? Kind of end where I started.
Well, your basic argument then would be it's unauthorized.
It's, well, the testimony from Reckless uses the word unauthorized about five times. It's also unjustifiable or wrongful because it was accomplished by fraud. It's at the core of what misapplication is all about, as defined by this circuit's model instructions, which are used in other circuits as well, and the cases. It goes further. We're not at the outer limits. And that's why, to respond to Judge Sada one last time, their hypotheticals don't help you do the job because they don't involve what you have here. Fraud and somebody whose authority clearly, just by virtue of his inability to reinstate the lanes when the truth came out, clearly did not encompass reducing the lanes to one combined for easy pass and cash just to gridlock Fort Lee.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Roth?
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll start quickly with the with the civil rights issue. You know, I don't think the government really grapples with the difference between Lutz in this case. The Lutz prohibited, legally prohibited you from traveling. We don't have that here. I get the analogy. I get the analogy that, well, it was hard for people to get from point A to point B, but they weren't prohibited from going from point A to point B. And we're talking about the Due Process Clause, fundamental right to liberty against the government. It's just different when the government is not prohibiting you on pain of some penalty, jail, fine, something, from actually moving from point A to point B. The government wants to distinguish the commuter cases. Those are two different. But it's not willing to take seriously the difference.
Mr. Keller said at the outset, let's assume for the moment you went on the 242 charge and conviction, but you lose on wire fraud and you lose on 666A. So what difference does it make in the end for your clients?
Well, it makes a difference in the sentence, at least potentially.
Potentially?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's always true when you have multiple counts and you vacate some and remand. It changes the sentencing guidelines range, and that may affect the sentence.
These sentences were within the range, were they not?
They were below the range.
They were below the range, that's right.
Yes. And if the range is lower, it could be below the new range. That's a question. That would be a question for the district court on remand, although let me go on to explain why reiterate why we're actually right about all three of the counts, and I'll move next to...
Well, let me ask the same question of you with regard that I asked Mr. Levy. Is the statute says unauthorized is one of the prongs you can...
No, Your Honor.
666A doesn't say unauthorized?
It says without authority, misapply or convert. Without authority is an additional...
Without authority does not mean unauthorized?
Without authority means unauthorized, so it has to be an unauthorized conversion or misapplication. Unauthorized is not a standalone element of the statute.
Wouldn't it be sufficient for criminal liability that the lanes have to be used in a way that was unauthorized?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by unauthorized. If the evidence was that that Baroni could not change the lane allocation without some sign-off, and he didn't get the sign-off, that would be an argument about lack of authority. And there's actually a circuit split on that question. The Seventh Circuit says no. The Second Circuit says yes.
The point that we had was that it's a gray area. No one appears to have had the authority necessarily. So if you don't have the authority and you exercise the authority, then the syllogism would be that you are doing something that's without authority, would it not?
That still would not be a misapplication if the resources are allocated to a public use, which they were. So it still has to be a theft, right? It has to be a theft either by embezzlement, by fraud, by conversion, or by misapplication. And the overriding point here is
additional cost and compensation.
Yes, but they didn't get that. In other words, they didn't obtain that money. They didn't obtain those services in any traditional sense, in any way comparable to any case that's ever been cited under Section 666. The money was paid to Port Authority staff to do Port Authority work. And the argument is their reason for making that decision was a bad reason. That is not enough under the statute to turn it into a crime. Let me just, Your Honor, add about authority, because Judge Ambrose has been asking about it. We asked for an instruction where the jury would be told if he had the authority to control the allocation of lanes, then you can't convict. And the district court refused to give that instruction. That's at JA 4595. So we really don't know what the jury thought in terms of authority. I will say the testimony on this was quite consistent, if you read it in context, that Baroni was considered to be at the highest level on the New Jersey side. Everyone testified he did not report to Foy. Foy, as a matter of law, had the power to override any decision because he's the only recognized official under the bylaws. But everyone testified, including the government's witnesses, Baroni did not report to Foy, and there was really no dispute, and I don't think there's any fair way to read the transcript, to say that he could not have made this decision for legitimate policy reasons. And then it all comes down to, and the government sort of admitted this, I think, at the very end of the presentation by saying, no one had the authority to do this in order to cause gridlock. Okay, we're now back to motive as the basis for their argument and its basis for the dividing line between the lawful conduct and the crime. If he had truly wanted to study traffic, if he had truly thought this was unfair to the mainline drivers, he had the authority to do it. Their argument is he had a bad reason for wanting to do it. That is what makes this like every earmark case and all the hypotheticals we give about the allocation of resources, often for political reasons. And the government's only answer to those hypotheticals is to say they didn't involve fraud. Actually, they do. Any time a public official makes a decision and says, this is in the best interest of the public, if it's actually, if he in his heart of hearts believes, well, no, this is really to buy votes, this is really to favor a special interest, this is really to protect the incumbent, any other number of things, and doesn't say that, doesn't announce that to the public, which, of course, you never do, then all of a sudden it's a violation of 666 on the government's theory.
Again, finish up with you, but the type of dumb question I asked the other side. It would seem if you wanted to send a message to the mayor of Fort Lee, okay, one day may have sent the message. Why go 4 days, and then when you're told to stop by Foy, try to go over Foy's head to say, no, I don't have to stop, indicating that this was going to go on indefinitely? Why not just send a message one day? You might not have been here today if this had just gone on for one day.
Your Honor, I don't really know the answer to the question. All I'll say is the evidence was that the lanes were allocated to Fort Lee 30 years ago as a political favor to Fort Lee, and that just stayed indefinitely. You know, it became the norm.
It's tradition, Reptevia, you know?
It stuck.
It's been there for three decades, and somebody decides with no notice to change it, and you want to send a message. The message was sent the first day, and then there was a lot of publicity. Then the second day, the third day, the fourth day, he's told not to do it. He tries to go over his head. I mean, it's like overkill on overkill.
That's a fair point, Your Honor, but the Baroni could have said just as easily, Fort Lee should not be getting these three lanes. I don't like Fort Lee anymore. Fort Lee is out of favor politically. It's going down to one indefinitely, and that's an absolutely legitimate decision from the perspective of Section 666. Maybe it's not optimal public policy, but this statute does not impose on state and local officials the requirement to act in optimally in the best interests of the public in some platonic sense, on otherwise you'll be thrown in jail.
I mean, what would have been a crime in your view here then?
Let me give you a number of examples. Baroni had said, the right-hand lane is going to be my lane, nobody else is allowed on it but me, and I will use it to make sure I never have to face traffic. Clear violation of Section 666. If Baroni had said, or if Kelly had said, I want the Port Authority police officers to come and provide security for my house, my private residence, clear violation of 666. Every case that has been decided under Section 666, misapplication prong in particular, involves facts almost identical to those. You're doing work on a private home, you're doing work on a private area, you're using staff for private benefit, private gain, personal use. There is no case that has said that allocating public resources from one constituency to another constituency could be considered wrongful or unjustifiable under the statute, and the Seventh Circuit decision in Thompson says exactly the opposite, that political considerations in making resource allocation decisions are completely lawful, and it's preposterous to think it would violate this statute, contrary to the rule of lenity, to the statute legislative history, to the caption. Every case that has been decided under this statute. The $5,000 came up again. If I could just say one word about that.
Okay, I'll give you one more minute.
Thank you very much. The government has now, I guess, identified where in the record some of the testimony came in about salary rates. It would have been nice to have seen that in the brief so we could respond, but I would say...
But the argument I've made to you on your opening and also to Mr. Levy was that it appears that you're challenging these things from a legal perspective, not as to the amounts that actually exist. With regard to the Senator Lemoyne study, it's 4440. the tollkeepers is 3696. The use of time from employees with regard to the scheming of this particular project was roughly $5,000.
Right. So let's say there's three groups. There's the tollkeepers at 36 and change. There's the Central Lemoyne at 4,400 and change. There's the other employees that we didn't know where the evidence was. It's not in the brief, but apparently it exists. I'm happy to take the government's word for it at this point. And the question is, did that get over the $5,000? Now, clearly it adds up to $5,000 if you put them all together. The problems are two. One, the instructions specifically said they could consider Center and Lemoyne. That's legally wrong. And in the absence of Center and Lemoyne, we don't know if the jury would have found both of the others to count towards the $5,000. The jury could have thought some of those salaries were bona fide compensation and did not count. And because the instructions erroneously told the jury to consider Center and Lemoyne, there's instructional error, and we don't know if the jury would have found the $5,000 satisfied. The other problem is the exemption, the bona fide exemption, as I was saying when I was up earlier. If it means anything, it's got to cover the people who would have been paid anyway and were doing work in good faith. That's what the cases say. If you're doing work in good faith for the employer.
Yeah, include Mr. Wildstein and others, at least in Wildstein's case, the work he was doing here, he acknowledged on the stand, wasn't in good faith.
Yes, I think you could distinguish the Wildstein time, but a lot of that time is engineer time. I mean, people who are looking at the data results of the stuff.
And Mr. Brown's time.
And the tollkeepers who would have, you know, were doing absolutely legitimate work. So for both of those reasons, the $5,000 is a separate basis. Right.
Thank you very much, Mr. Levy. Absolutely.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to touch very briefly on the $5,000. I don't think it's the biggest issue, but before moving past it, on Mr. Wildstein's and Mr. Brony's time, the issue here is, and why the government can't get the harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt, the jury was free to disregard those, for example. Mr. Wildstein worked way more than 40 hours a week. Mr. Brony worked way more than 40 hours a week. A jury could very easily have said, it no more cheats the Port Authority out of their time for them to have spent a few hours thinking about this than for them to have spent a few hours surfing the web at their desk. As long as he's putting in a full week, a full year, a jury could very easily have disregarded that. The time spent for the other people, other than the overtime toll collector, also, jury was free to conclude that some of that time was unnecessary, but not all of it. We don't know. If you carve out Center and Lemoyne, the only number that the jury was ever given was the overtime collector, and that comes below $3,000. The government is trying to argue harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt after an instructional error that we preserved.
I think the government is going to submit something to us that shows where in the record, in presentation to the jury, these numbers were.
I will preview for you that if you look at JA 5295 to 96, the summation, you will not see any of the math that Mr. Keller just promised you. The number 5,000 appears. That is the only number you're going to see there. You're not going to see any of the here's how you compute the hourly wages of this person, and here's how if you multiply this by that. That's not there. Ultimately, on the other two counts, what the government's position comes down to is Mr. Brony was not allowed to do this, and he lied about it, but he was allowed to do this. That's the core difference between our positions. Mr. Brony is a public official who, if he had just said out loud, I am taking these two lanes away from Fort Lee and giving them to mainline drivers because I don't like the split, and frankly, Fort Lee is out of political favor. Nobody could argue that that is a crime. The government has argued that that is a crime. They say all political is personal, and personal is misuse. That is the core fallacy of their argument. But had Mr. Brony done that, it's legitimate. Blagojevich says that it is okay. Thompson says it is okay that politics does not need to be separated from public life. It was scoffed at in the wire fraud context that politics needs to be removed from that sort of decision making. And I'd point out, in the wire fraud context, that they were talking about concealed political interests. So the second part of the government's argument is, okay, he lied about it. He didn't admit that that was what he was doing. It would have been okay if he'd said it, but instead, to his subordinates, he said it was something else. Blagojevich says there is no rule of truth in politics like that. Justice Scalia and the Solicitor General have said that concealed political interests are just something we have to deal with in this country. Politicians don't come out and say, I am giving you this because I like your representative and he voted for me on something or he endorsed me. I am taking this away because he didn't do those things. We don't expect and criminalize that behavior. Judge Seiler, you asked the government for what their best case was, and they said Ferriero. I would argue this case is unprecedented. Ferriero has nothing to do with this case. It's a fraud case. If their argument is there are fraud cases and this is a fraud case, that's about as close as it gets. Chico throws out a case like this. Thompson throws out a case like this. McDonnell, 2 years ago, does exactly the analysis.
Very quickly, the argument on Chico is whether it can be distinguished or not, and there's a good argument it could, is that it's followed by a trilogy of Supreme Court cases that clarify you looked at the language in the text, not the language in the caption.
I think those cases don't do anything to Chico's analysis for the following reason. They were dealing with a different part of that statute. There is clearly an intention by the federal government to have an expansive view of the federalness of whatever's going on with these programs. That was the whole point of the statute, was that this property had previously been out of federal hands and could be prosecuted, and that's what was gotten at. None of those cases say that you should look at the verbs of the conduct and decide that that's it. And I want to say on a final point on Goodrich, Mr. Keller tried to distinguish away our cases in which we say that that courts have recognized when the government is trying to use money or property in a pretextual way to get over an invalid honest services fraud situation. And he said all the cases we have are cases where it was already infected and it was a matter of weeding it out on appeal. Goodrich is not that. Goodrich pled it exactly this way. They initially pled it in the indictment as honest services fraud. McDowell came down. They superseded while that motion to dismiss was pending, and they offered a theory exactly like this one. They said, this is the money or property. We've changed our theory. Now it's money or property. And the district court looked at it on exactly those terms and said that you can't do that. We're not going to allow that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you to all counsel for very well-presented arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement. I would ask that counsel get together with the clerk's office and have a transcript prepared of this oral argument and split it half for this side, half for that side, so you can do the 50% however you wish. And again, we will take a short recess.